Please note that this podcast contains information regarding sensitive events, including domestic violence, assault, and abuse, as well as other triggering events, such as murder. This podcast is intended for mature audiences. When Alice jumped down the rabbit hole, she immediately regretted her decision. A rabbit hole is a metaphor for something that transports someone into a troubling, surreal state or situation. Welcome to Afterglow, the unveiling of the Idaho cult. This is season 1, episode 13, Their Mission. This podcast will take you down the deepest of rabbit holes as it unfolds. Stories so compelling, so bizarre, and so heinous, it's impossible to look the other way. Chad Daybell and Lori Vallow were dedicated in the most horrible way to an ideology that should only be fiction. Instead, their ideology put them behind bars. Join us as we explore the lives, lies, and diabolical crimes of Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell. I'm your host, Kathy Brooks. Please follow and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Hello, and welcome back to all of you. Thank you so much for all of you that have gotten this far. Literally, we are in episode 13. Today's episode will be the end of season 1. I have to take care of a lot of personal things over the next few weeks, and I will be going on vacation until the middle of September. So at that point, I will come back the first week of October with season 2, and we will keep digging deep, deep, deep. So while I take a break and get my personal life, my work life, and my R&R time, I would love for you to just go back and catch up on everything that you might have missed. You can also enjoy my YouTube channel. There's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of videos on there regarding this case and a lot of other cases as well. My YouTube channel is Left Undone, Incomplete Investigations. But now let's get into episode 13, Their Mission. This was sent from Chad to Lori. And basically, it shows that they were starting their own church with a new presidency. They had lined out 7 missions to accomplish together. 1 is to translate ancient records. 2, write the book about the translation process. 3, identify locations in Northeast Arizona for white camps. And 4, presidency of the Church of the Firstborn. 5, help establish the food distributions as the tribulations start. And the delegate. 6, ordain individuals to translation as the camps begin. And 7, provide supplies to righteous members of families. I'm going to play a brief clip of an interview that Nate Eaton had with an anonymous person that believed all this stuff, and just give you a little bit of information of how she was explaining how that they what they were prepared for, why they moved to that area, that Rexburg area, and how much money they gave up in order to buy their tents and be prepared for this doomsday that Chad and friends were predicting. They really did put fear in a lot of people.
You were raised in the church. Mm-hmm. What was your childhood like?
My parents were converts to the church. We went to church every Sunday. We had family meeting every Monday. We did scripture study every night. I did early morning seminary. You might be able to say I graduated high school a year early so that I didn't have to do that fourth year of early morning seminary. I met my former husband at Institute, and we were married and moved up to Rexburg to attend BYU-Idaho.
How many children do you have?
I have 3 children, but there have also been 6 foster children.
You guys left Rexburg, mm-hmm, and moved to
Amarillo, Texas.
Texas, and you moved back in 2015.
Yes. We meet a guy, and he is chatty and friendly, and probably 3 weeks later, I got a phone call one day, and it was this person, and he had told me that, you know, he just kept being prompted to call me. He had an accounting firm, so he invited me over for an interview, which ended up being really casual. And we talked through what my goals were and what I was looking for. And he had just moved his practice from another state. And so he was looking to kind of build things from the ground up.
Pretty normal encounter, just...
Yes.
I mean, nothing abnormal or anything, just, hey, I might need some help in my office. Are you interested?
Yes. Well, but everything was toned with, like, God is telling me that this is what I should do, and he's been harassing me about it, or, you know, he's been pestering me that I need to talk to you.
So this, to me, is the beginning of a grooming process. God's telling me that I need you. And this goes all along the same lines of what Chad does.
So when did you start to witness abnormal behaviors?
I don't remember the timeline exactly, but it was probably that first month where he shared with me some of his spiritual gifts.
He volunteered that.
He volunteered that information. I think in part it was because he was counseling people who were struggling with that, who had spirits inside of them and needed to be cast out, whether it was to help with pornography or other addictions or other illnesses.
So the story she's telling is quite similar to what we've been listening to. The other audios talking about casting out evil spirits, that they need to groom these people, tell them that they are helping them get rid of evil spirits, because if they're into pornography or addiction or anything else or sickness, they're possessed by evil spirits. Same belief system that Chad's been selling to Lori and Lori's selling to other people, etc. That's one of the reasons why I named this Unveiling the Idaho Cult. Because it's not just Chad and Lori, and this is still going on.
Okay, so he's telling you that he's counseling with these people and evil spirits, and you just think, oh, that's...
It is what it is.
It is what it is.
Yes, it is what it is. I'm not going to sit here and worry about it too much. And he had shared it in part because these people would sometimes come during the workday, and his office would be closed, and so I would not be able to interrupt. His friends knew about his spiritual gift. And they would tell their friends. So it was a word of mouth. It was his spiritual gift. And so he honored God by utilizing his spiritual gift.
So it wasn't part of his church position or part of his professional position.
No.
This was people that heard he had this gift. So they were coming to him to be healed.
Yes.
So clearly selling exactly what Chad started selling to everyone else. I have spiritual gifts. I can see on the other side of the veil. I can heal. It's all blasphemy.
Where did it go from there?
So there was a speaker coming to Rexburg at the end of July, and he was so excited. He had read all of her books, and I think he'd even met her before, but it was one of Chad Daybell's authors, and he offered to get me tickets. I think he was either saying the prayer or helping conduct it somehow. But he got tickets for my former husband and I and my brother and my mom to attend. And he was just so excited about it. And
Chad Daybell published this woman's books.
Yes, Chad Daybell was the publisher of this woman's books. But I had realized really quickly he was also a big prepper. He was preparing for end days. He'd been reading the dreams and visions that had been compiled by different people. And that was something that my former husband and I had been, you know, into.
And that's what this event talked about.
Yes. Yes. This event was very focused on that. The big thing that I took away from it was from like Yukon North was going to be a city of light and a city of refuge and a place for the saints and the faithful to gather and be protected from the calamities that come as things kind of fall apart.
Which from what we understand is a belief that Chad Daybell has that Rexburg is kind of a chosen land.
Yes.
And that's why he brought his family up here in 2015, around this time.
Yes.
And eventually I'll get into some of the emails that have been sent to me. But yes, this is exactly what was going on. Chad Daybell and these other people were telling people that Rexburg was the place, the safe place. And remember, he said that at that speech we listened to, that Rexburg, it's not St. George, it's Little Rexburg.
Do you know, was Chad there?
Oh, yeah. And I think I met him at my employer's house either a couple days before or a couple days after. And that was the first time that I'd met him, was during that time period.
Chad, though, was obviously well respected.
Oh, he was idolized. The thing that really surprised me at that gathering was seeing how I'd never seen so many people that believed in this idea of tent cities, because that's the easiest way to call it is.
What is that idea?
Okay.
Explain the tent city idea.
Okay, because if you say tent cities and somebody knows what you mean, it's like you instantly connect and, oh my gosh, cool, you're into this.
And remember, we covered all the big trucks were going to pull up to all these prepared people's homes, and they were going to take all their year's supply of food and take it to these tent cities. And then another big bus was going to collect all the people and bring them there to the new, when the tribulations began, to where they were safe. And Lori and Chad, and I don't know if I remember bringing this one up or not, but they said they didn't need to live in a tent because they were in charge of the 144,000. I got to dig that up again because that one was really bizarre. But I can just picture Lori, oh, I don't know about a tent, Chad. And then Chad went, oh, no, not us. Like, we're cool. We're in charge. So we don't have to live in the actual tent. We can live in something far more spectacular. That's just what I hear in my head.
I don't know what you mean.
I know you
so,
don't.
So if you could explain what tent cities are.
Sure. So one of the common ideas with members of the church who are focused on kind of the end times and preparing for the coming of Christ and the tribulations is this idea that some random Sunday, the bishop's going to come into Priesthood Relief Society and ask anybody who has their food stores to come join in another meeting. And he's going to say, it's time, we've been called out to go wherever, and you need to bring your food store to the church, storage to the church. They'll load it up on trucks, and then you leave. You know, people had their large canvas tents. We cashed out retirement at one point to buy that and more.
Wait, hold on. You and your husband.
Yes.
So, no, you don't have to laugh.
No, I'm laughing because of the absurdity of it now. Yeah. But we had two 16 by 20, 20 by 24 canvas tents. And they were so, and we had the massive cots from Cabela's and below 30 sleeping bags and a stove and a year's supply of charcoal to cook three meals a day. In these kind of prepper tent city communities, we believed that there would be a time that we would be called out. And if we weren't, then there would be a time that these items would be needed. And so we had a year's supply of certified gluten-free food storage because I had celiac. We had stuff to keep us warm. We had cloth diapers and little sets of scriptures because you never know whose kids you're going to be helping take care of.
Any idea how much money you spent on all that?
At least $15,000 to $20,000.
Wow.
And I have emails from people that know people that literally mortgaged their houses, sold everything, bought all these tents, made all these storage plans, and moved to that area because they were so fearful. I will dig up those emails because they're super interesting. As we get through this story, I definitely want to circle back to that because there are people that really have reached out to me that told me that they had to rewire their own brain to realize that this was all BS.
The boss continued to, looking back now, to not be normal.
Yes. Yes. So there would be times where we'd be encountering constant software issues, whether it's a web-based product or a computer-based product. And eventually he said, hey, if you're noticing this happening, let me know, because it's usually we're getting some kind of interference. He always had what he called a shield of protection around his house and eventually extended that to be around the houses of all of his employees.
Invisible protection, right?
Yes.
I mean, we're not talking about a fence here.
Nope. We're talking about a spiritual shield of protection.
And how did he get that?
He knelt and prayed and invoked his priesthood authority.
So he said that the business was protected.
Yes.
And if you had any computer problems, let him know.
Yes, so that he could reinforce those protections or cast something out that got through. So if the computers are acting up, you holler upstairs to where his office is and you say, hey, can you take care of things?
So he's casting spirits out of computers, putting shields around the home and around the business. And you think that this is normal? I mean, you didn't think anything abnormal about it.
Like, I knew it was different, but I'm not going to judge what works for somebody, or at that time, I wasn't going to judge what works for somebody. And it was always interesting as new employees came on, because it'd be a couple weeks and then he would say, okay, I'm going to tell her today.
Chad would occasionally come by.
So yes, Chad had come by at least twice. I met him at work. But there were other members of this community. It was a constant subject of conversation. We were always talking either about, you know, what people were doing or what was happening in the work.
How long were you there? 4 years?
I was there for 3 years.
3 years. What caused you to finally leave?
So I was invited to let an employee go, as what appeared to be a growing experience, in 2017. And it went badly and was enormously, triggering emotionally. And, I had struggled with PTSD from, abuse and neglect in my childhood and other traumatic events. And it really caused a recurrence of, the anxiety and a lot of those struggles. And so my employer was kind enough to, set me up with this, counselor slash energy worker that he'd been working with. And we did, and she did it for free for me since I worked for him. And, we did twice weekly counseling sessions over the phone for about 6 months, from the fall of 2017 to early 2018. And during these, it was a form of modified hypnosis. And every now and then, she would be encountering interference. So she would ask my boss to sit in on the sessions and help cast out spirits. And sometimes it wasn't needed, but he sat in on many of those sessions. And so towards the end of this work with her, my constant prayer began to be, I want to be able to see things as they are and not the story I've always told myself. As I'd been studying healing from trauma and abuse and neglect, one of the common themes was just that we rationalize and we tell ourselves that, you know, so-and-so is a good person. But the reality is if this is happening, so-and-so is not a good person or their behavior is not good.
And you see, they prey on people that have suffered from abuse, emotional abuse, neglect, people that already have behavioral health kind of internal issues that they're struggling with, mental health issues that they're struggling with, and they prey on these people and they indoctrinate them and make them feel like they have something special and that they can help fix them and they can get them with this energy work and stuff. And usually they're taking their money. Look at Julie Rowe. We need to get into Julie Rowe.
And so I spent 2 weeks with that as an active prayer and had a breakthrough about the trauma that I'd experienced in my life. I knew that this was the priority, dealing with my family and my emotional well-being. And so at first I just realized I need to step away from the church. Every decision I'd made there over the course of my life had been out of fear of not being loved, fear of not being cared for. And I guess this is a good time to say, I know that there are people that the church is an absolutely wonderful part of their life, that it is a great piece of their fantastic personality and the service that they do. My children are still members of the church. My parents are still members of the church. So I share this very aware of the possibility that it can hurt others' feelings, but it was for me and my life.
So you not only have to, in a way, leave this group, but leave the church.
Yes.
But at the time, you're thinking it's all the same.
I'm thinking it's all the same, and I don't even see how work and the marriage are all connected with it. So at first, I was just going to go inactive for a little bit so that I could focus on this part and not try to piece together or untangle the confusion that had come up with my faith. Faith crisis is what we often call it. And, but I quickly realized within a matter of weeks that I could not sit in my skin knowing that I was not living up to my covenants. The promises that we make in the temple, at baptism, the idea of being a bad Mormon, was absolutely unacceptable. And so I ultimately decided and consulted with my husband at the time and with his dad and realized, like, this is the best thing. And so I resigned from the church in March of 2018. My family, my children all remained members. I ended up having the opportunity to go down and work with somebody in Utah. And I spent 28 days as an outpatient there. And he specialized in trauma and PTSD.
So you're going through this therapy. You're realizing you've got to find out who you really are. And meanwhile, what's happening at work?
He was not in the office very much. He would be out in Wyoming filming things for something. And so I was running the business and taking on too much responsibility. And more importantly, I was taking on too much of a mental load. And I would go through cycles of frustration. And so I left my job, but I had helped. We were partners in the building entity. So we still had frequent interaction, or at least the ex-husband did. And it was very uncomfortable. I didn't trust. From the moment that I left in April and when I quit in May, I became scared of my former boss. And not necessarily because of anything he did, but I didn't trust myself around him because I knew I didn't have boundaries. I knew that I had deferred to his knowledge and expertise or spiritual standing for so long that I couldn't trust myself.
Spiritually, you were scared of him, or physically too?
Spiritually and mentally.
You didn't think he'd hurt you?
No. But that, no, I was never worried about that.
But that he might mess with your
yes,
emotions.
That he was going to mess with my emotions.
Yeah.
I had learned the phrase gaslighting at that time and was realizing that that's what I'd been experiencing. After I left my job, it was as though my former husband, who knew all the details about the dysfunction in my work environment and in my work relationships, it was as though he had forgotten all of that and began twisting things around and using the stories that my former employer was saying. I just knew that staying in that marriage was not acceptable or reasonable or a good decision.
The story breaks. And I think you messaged me within a day or two, or an hour or two maybe.
I think I messaged you within an hour or so. I was laying in bed and I saw the kids' pictures and I scrolled up and I saw Chad's name. And it was like I came unglued. I immediately texted my office manager at my job at that time and said, "Oh my goodness, is he a client?" Because I was trying to remember how I knew this guy's name. How did I know him? And she replied back pretty quickly, "No, he's not." And that's when, I put my hands down on the bed like this, and I realized what all of this was. I realized it was Chad, and it was from my first job. And I'd had a friend, a really good friend, who came over one night about 6 months ago, 8 months ago, and we were just chatting. And for whatever reason, I started telling her how into the prepper stuff we were. And I started telling her about what I had experienced in my work environment. And she sat there dumbfounded and told me that I had been in a cult and that none of this stuff was okay. And I didn't believe her.
And this is a Latter-day Saint?
This is an active Latter-day Saint.
So what is it about the LDS religion that some people are very easily swayed into these fringe belief systems, these cult belief systems? And then other LDS people are like, "What the hell are you thinking? That's a cult." What is it that can sway so many of them into this, "You're the chosen, you're going to be saved, you're one of the most important, you're have evil spirits, you need casting out"? I don't understand, because I am not LDS, but it kind of boggles my mind a bit.
She told you you've been in a cult.
She told me I was in a cult. And she told me that this was abuse and that it wasn't okay. And I remember sitting there and like, okay, I hear the words you're saying. I'm not going to internalize them because I don't know what to do with them. And that just seems crazy. I was just super faithful. So when I saw that day, I freaked, because It meant that she was right.
Why did you decide to talk publicly about this?
I feel an enormous amount of shame for staying in a dysfunctional environment with gaslighting and manipulation for so long. I feel enormous shame for staying in an unhealthy marriage. I feel shame for believing the things that I believed. If there's another person in my shoes who's dealing with this and it's under the guise of, you know, spiritual guidance or trying to help keep you on the path to God or keeping you, you know, in a place where you can receive the blessings that God has for you, I want that person to be able to see that they might need to look at it from a different angle. I've had constant stomach troubles throughout my life, and I had celiac for 7 years at that point, and my intestines were just really struggling. And one day my employer and I were talking, and I was probably crying because I was hurting so bad, and he said, "Don't you have the faith to be healed?" But that day in his office, I was hurting so much and I was so desperate to not be in pain that like there was a shift in my mind, and I decided, okay, I'm gonna see if I can get to a place where I feel like I could be healed. And I talked about it with my former husband. I talked about it with my boss. And a week or two later, on Mother's Day, 2016, they gave me a blessing and healed my celiac and healed my blood sugar issues. And they healed hormonal imbalances and thyroid issues to where I stopped taking all my thyroid medicine and my supplements. And I slowly got to where I wasn't so scared. And I eventually tried eating bread and I didn't have a reaction.
In my opinion, I attribute what she's talking about, her healing, this energy healing, this casting out these whatever they're doing to people to cure them, as the placebo effect. A placebo is anything that seems to be like a real medicine, a real cure, a real treatment, but it isn't. Placebos can be a pill, they can be a shot, they can be any kind of fake treatment. Again, energy healing. One thing that all placebos do have in common is that they don't contain any kind of active substance that could actually treat whatever their ailment is. And sometimes people can have a response to the placebo. The response, their symptoms might improve, or they may have a side effect and blame the placebo. And that is what's known as the placebo effect.
And so I kept...
So they truly healed you?
That's what I thought. I genuinely believe they did. I knew that it would take months before it would show in my system because I had been gluten-free so strict and so long that I tested negative for it at that point.
But you started to feel better.
Yeah, I was feeling better. I was eating. It was lovely to not obsess about food and worry about that. And I knew at some point I'll go to the doctor and just get tested to make sure that I'm not doing any damage to my body. But 2 years later, I end up in the GI doctor's office and I'm telling him what I'm feeling at that point. My stomach's upset more often. I'm having trouble eating certain foods. And he says, "Oh, that sounds a lot like celiac." And I had told him about the blessing, understanding he'd be skeptical. I was ex-Mormon at that time. And he said, "Let's do a biopsy and confirm." And sure enough, it comes back that I had active celiac. And I had been, after that, as I adapted to, well, now I have to be gluten-free again, I had been told by a handful of people that, well, maybe it was my lack of faith that undid the healing. And so the other reason I speak to you.
Yes, we have consequences in this world for our actions, but God isn't punishing you. He didn't make your celiac disease come back because you didn't have faith in these wackadoodles that were trying to persuade you into this new belief system that they were prophets, that they were telling you the right way to go, that they can see beyond the veil. That's the difference.
is because I was so wrapped up in all of this that as an intelligent woman who'd had a disease for 7 years and had done all the research, I believed I'd been healed enough to start eating bread again. And after 2 years had done an enormous amount of damage to my intestines.
There will be people that say you're just disgruntled at your old boss, or you're disgruntled toward the church, or, well, you got caught up in that crazy stuff. You know, you should have thought otherwise. What would you say to those people watching?
It took me 2 years to talk about this to somebody outside of my former husband. So to the people who want to say that I'm doing this because I'm disgruntled or angry, they're going to believe what they want to believe. I would rather have sat in my house tonight watching Netflix. And to those who think I'm here to rail on the doctrine or rail on the church, like, I'm now starting to see that I'm Mormoned wrong. My brother and I joke about that. He has also left the church in the last year. But we joke about how our sisters seem to be able to Mormon right. There's some flexibility. They can be nuanced. They make it work for them. But we were so black and white and rigid in our thinking. And I was so in this group of righteous obsession. And that I couldn't do it right. And so even now, I don't know that I'd ever go back. But do you know, in a year and a half, 2 years, when my daughter's going to be 8, I'll be there with my baptism dress for her to wear. And I will do her hair, and I will help her get dressed, and I will sit there with a big smile on my face, and I will support her on that day. When my boys decide to get married and sealed in the temple, I will sit outside of that temple and be an awesome, smiling mom, because that's what I can do for my children. I can support them in their spiritual beliefs and their frame of reference, even though I live in a way that's completely different than that.
Many thanks to Nate Eaton of East Idaho News for that interesting interview. Much appreciated. He is an excellent source for this case. Now, to hop back into where we left off on the timeline, we ended episode 12 at the end of July 2019, after Charles was murdered and Lori had found out that she was no longer the recipient of his life insurance policy. We heard a little bit from Colby about how he found out that his stepfather, Charles, was shot by Uncle Alex, and he seemed like he was a little bit flabbergasted and quite clueless about what actually happened and why. He was busy with Kelsey, his wife, raising a new baby, and he was, from what he says, very disconnected from all of what his mom had going on. In the Freedom of Information Act, the FOIA documents, there is a document in there that shows that Lori, from either her account or Tylee's account, was sending a lot of money to Colby. And in the FOIA documents, it says, Colby explained he has also received sporadic mobile payments from Lori via Venmo. Colby explained it was not unusual for Lori to give him money and pay for services for he and Kelsey, such as a cellular phone service. The detective says, Colby provided me with screen-captured images of Venmo transactions to his account from both Lori's account and Blank's account, which would be Tylee's account. Lori would be sending him payments from these Venmo accounts. Colby also provided a second Venmo account for Lori, identified as, and this is redacted, but Colby has not received any payments from that account. And then the detective goes on to say, I reviewed Colby's Venmo account transaction history and noted the following transactions transferred to Colby from either those two accounts, again, redacted. The following is a summary of the transactions per the screen captured image provided by Colby. So there are Venmo transactions that go from, the first one is April 9th, 2019, and they go on and on and on. There's none in July of 2019. There is in June. And then on August 1st, so the first one after Charles was shot and killed was August 1st, 2019, August 5th, August 24th. There's one on 9-8, 9-10, and 9-23. October 1st, 6th, 10th, 14th, 16th, 25th, 25th, two times, 27th, 29th, October 31st, November 3rd, 5th, 8th, 11th, 14th, 21st, and 23rd. So, and they go all the way until December 19th, 2019. So Colby, you know, was getting a lot of money from his mom. I think that was probably somewhat normal for Lori and Charles. Charles, from what I was understanding, is Charles was paying for cell phones for Lori's entire family, her parents, everybody. There was like, I forget what Kay said, like 17 or 18 cell phones on their account that Charles was paying for. So that wasn't that unusual. But again, by this time, Charles is dead and there was a lot going on with Lori. On August 5th, 2019, JJ did start the new school year at Life Academy, which is the school in Arizona.
Missy Inglet uncovered a very detailed timeline.
What we found out is JJ's enrollment was a bit of a roller coaster. Through this timeline, the school details some of the conflict between Charles and Lori Vallow. We start in February 2019 in Gilbert, Arizona, where JJ Vallow is attending school at Lawrence Institute for Education, or LIFE. On February 5th, JJ is absent from school. 6 days later, Charles visits the school, claiming Lori had gone crazy and was hearing religious voices. She had also disappeared to an unknown location. The same day, Charles says he has a protection order against Lori. And he tells LIFE he's pulling JJ out of school and taking him out of state until he's safe. Days later, Charles files for divorce from Lori. On February 21st, Charles and JJ return to LIFE Academy. Lori is still MIA. Moving to March, Charles formally withdraws JJ from school, saying they're going to Texas. Fast forward to late June, Lori contacts LIFE saying the family was back in Gilbert and she enrolled JJ in the school's summer program. On July 11th, Charles Vallow is shot and killed by Lori's brother, Alex Cox. About a week and a half later, Lori tells JJ's school that Charles committed suicide. Through their own research, LIFE learns Charles was killed as part of a family dispute. So as part of its due diligence policy, the school files a report with Arizona's Department of Child Safety. On August 5th, JJ starts the new school year at LIFE. Later that month, JJ's grandparents, Kay and Larry Woodcock, contact the school asking if JJ was okay. On September 5th, Lori withdraws JJ from LIFE via email and phone. In the email, which KTVB obtained, Lori says she's moving out of state for a new job and JJ won't be returning to school. Finally, December 2019, a detective contacts the school.
So here is a conversation, messages regarding the situation between the school and the detectives. Dear detective, I'm going to start sending you records and emails we have regarding JJ. Below is a summary of our history with this situation. I believe the two people you want to speak with is my director of academy administration, Lori Kleinman, and my director of student services, Jamie No. They both have firsthand information. I am summarizing below. His teacher, Nicole Zins, would be another one. However, she left us at the end of last school year. I believe she went to the Chandler School District. Here's what I can share. Around February 5th, JJ became absent from school. Around February 11th of 2019, Charles, the dad, came in and shared that Lori, the mom, had gone crazy and had lost it. He had no idea where she was, and she just disappeared. He further mentioned Lori was speaking about religious voices speaking to her. He shared he had an order of protection in place. This was not for JJ, but rather for mom and dad. So between the two, Lori and Charles, there was an order of protection. No, not an order of protection that involved JJ. He shared he was taking JJ to Louisiana to be with family until he felt JJ was safe. Charles and JJ did return to us around February 21st. To our knowledge, mom was still not to be found. Lori Kleinman did make a report to CPS, given the talk of mom still being gone and different order of protections, to ensure we were doing our due diligence in protecting JJ. Around the 1st of March, Charles withdrew JJ and shared he was taking JJ to Texas to be with family. He was withdrawn technically on March 7th. We did not hear further from the family. Around late June, we were contacted by mom, sharing that she and Charles were back in Gilbert with JJ, and they wanted to see if he could join our summer program, which we did enroll him in. JJ started back with us in our summer program, and I believe back with therapies. We then received an email from Lori asking if they could enroll JJ back in our private academy with Miss Nicole, his previous school teacher. At the end of July, Lori came in to share with us that Charles had committed suicide and JJ didn't know. This was between the week of July 22nd and July 26th. We believe she shared this with us. Lori had shared it had happened the week before. Given how strange the situation and the history was, Jamie No and Lori Kleinman Googled Charles Vallow, at which time we learned he had been killed in a family altercation on July 11th. When JJ started his academy year with us on August 5th, he was in Miss Julia's classroom. To our knowledge, JJ was told his dad was traveling. He did have days where he seemed sad and distressed. Close to his last day with us, he did share with Miss Julia, "My dad is not in heaven, he is traveling." Mom withdrew via email and phone on September 5th. Mom shared she got a promotion in California and needed to leave immediately. We were never able to get Mom to follow the formal process with signatures, and we never received a request from his new school asking for his records, which are not normal. It should also be noted that Charles' parents, JJ's grandparents, contacted us in August stating they had not been able to see JJ and they wanted to know if he was okay. We were limited to what we could share given the current paperwork we had on file. I will be sending you documents very shortly. Once you've had a chance to review everything, please feel free to reach out to me and we can set a time to meet face to face if you like. I can share I am deeply distressed as to the well-being of JJ, and I do hope this helps him. Margaret Trivelon, co-founder and CEO. So as you can see, we're getting very close to the disappearance of JJ and Ty Lee. Charles is murdered in July. By August, there's a lot of weird stuff going on with the school. And Kay and Larry are getting a little bit concerned because they're unable to speak to JJ. Now, I have to put in a shout out to Annie Cushing. I had all my files and everything with all this information and the order, and I was going through all of it and all of it. And I remember that Annie is the most organized person in this case ever. And she has a website, her blog, where she has put the timeline together so perfectly with links to sources. Her website is Annielytics, AnnieLytics.com. So if you want to go dive into the timeline yourself, it's right there. She's provided it publicly and to law enforcement and media. So we do have to appreciate that very, very much. Thank you, Annie Cushing. On August 2nd, Melanie Gibb hosts a meeting at Lori's house, and David Warwick is invited to speak. And this is the letter that Melanie Gibb sent out. "Dear friends, August 2nd at 6 p.m. at Lori's home, I asked David Warwick if he would come down to Arizona to speak to us about some of his dreams about things that are coming upon our nation. David has been shown visions ever since he was 11 years old of future events. For some reason, the Lord has shown him the tribulations and the building of Zion for the second coming of the Lord. He loves to share with his brother and sisters because of his love for his fellow man. He shares humbly and loves to help others prepare for the Lord's coming. We will be having our class in Lori's home. I will be sending your address soon. Please let me know if you can come. We are looking forward to seeing you. I miss you guys. Please RSVP. Love you guys, Melanie Gibb." So in the meantime, that was going on, and the meeting was hosted there. And interestingly enough, David did share his testimony, I suppose. Chad Daybell did come to town for this, and Zalema apparently reported this is the first time that she saw Lori and Chad have any kind of romantic relationship together. And in the FOIA documents, it says after Charles died, Zalema went on vacation to Chile. A couple weeks after she returned, Lori had another meeting at her house in Chandler. Chad was at this meeting, and this was the first time she ever saw Lori and Chad being romantic with each other. Zalema stated that this meeting was at the end of July. Zalema indicated that it was at this meeting that they started to talk about people moving to Rexburg. So from the timeline, it would have been that meeting on August 2nd. So Zalema sends this message to Lori on August 1st. It says, oh, did you know that Serena is moving to Queen Creek, like soon? Lori said, what? When? Zalema says, she's flying in tomorrow looking at houses this weekend. And the kids fly in Tuesday. I mean soon. Lori is like, so she's staying with you? ? The reply was, with Christina. Lori says, that's not good. Christina is also stalled and in a downward spiral. Going to have to ask how to handle this. Can we, meaning you and I, get together this weekend? So Lori's saying that Christina and Serena have stalled in their translation process. They're not being translated beings like they once were. And remember how she talks about, you know, they got kicked out basically from the group at some point. And in that police interview, she's saying she got kicked out because she was basically, she was asking too many questions. And then Zalema replies, absolutely. I have so much to tell you. Chad just checked for me and I did bring the earthquake to Chile today. So again, there's Zalema. Chad, did I do this? Chad, that? Chad, this? And Chad confirmed to Zalema that the earthquake in Chile that day was because she was able to bring it on. And does any of this make any logical sense to any of you? Why do these people want destruction? Why do these people want earthquakes? Like, why is this a good thing? The elements, this whole part of this makes, it just makes no sense to me that it would be anything positive, even for people that are trying to head into the new millennium or New Jerusalem or tribulations. Lori replies, yes, you did. I'm a proud mama because you are amazing. We have a lot of work to do. This is just the beginning. Zalema replies, yes, it is. Exciting and at the same, a sobering thought. She also then says, I just landed in Phoenix. And she said, yay, is someone picking you up? And she said, yes, my son is on his way. Feels so good to be home. I cast it out and created shields. And right after the plane broke, the flight was delayed so much. Most people left because they're connecting flights, which gave us room to be on this flight. God is so good. And Lori says, try dat. I think she meant true that. It's T-R-Y-D-A-T, true dat. I think she's trying to be cool and say true dat. Whatever, Lori. And then on August 7th, 2019, Kelsey Ryan starts a GoFundMe for medical bills. You can click on it. It's still there. It just says, when I click over to it, it just says help with medical bills. And there's a picture of Kelsey and Colby holding the baby. And it said $260 was raised. It says this fundraiser is no longer accepting donations. It was for medical bills. And it was posted August 7th, 2019. You know, I have to say, I spoke with Colby on the phone. He was supposed to come on my show at one point. I can't remember, like a year and a half ago, maybe. And he was such a nice man. I mean, our conversation was very pleasant. He was very happy. He said he was very grateful for everything that my channel has done to keep their story in the light and be out there. And then they started their YouTube channel. And they went live, I think like the night after that, to tell everyone they were going to come on my show. And there were several trolls in the chat. And I don't know what happened, but someone put some kind of thought in their mind or brain. And Colby sent me an email and he backed out of my interview with him. And that's fine. It would have been nice to be able to speak to him. My audience was actually looking really forward to it. But in the land of YouTube, there's a lot of backstabbing and stuff that goes on. And again, one of the reasons why I prefer the podcast platform, because there's not an active running chat going on. There's not people conspiring with each other in the chat. I mean, there are people that follow true crime in, on the YouTube channels that literally that's in their entire life. And they're more than happy to cause drama. But I just wanted to point out that Colby was a very nice young man. He seemed very responsible and very grateful. And he, if Lori did anything right, she raised a very nice young man. That's my point. And then for whatever reason, on August 8th, 2019, Lori traded in her car. She and Zalema have text messages about this. She says at 6:01 p.m., she says, sorry, I'm at the car dealer trying to trade in my car. And she said, you can check, you can text it to Chad. He will check. And then the reply was, oh my, I'm sorry. I didn't know you were going to do that. So Lori is getting in preparation for something. She's getting rid of her car. I don't know why she needed a new car, but I, clearly she felt she needed a new car for some reason. And that was on August 8th. Now here's where I start to see in the timeline that they're planning something ominous. August 9th, 2019, Lori puts JJ Vallow's service dog Bailey up for sale in Chandler. It says, Bailey has such a sweet spirit. He has brought so much love to his home, but his owner recently died and he needs a new home. He is fully trained with certification as a service dog, up to date on vaccinations. He has been trained with children in the home, non-smoking home. Bailey is sweet and friendly around other dogs, looking for new owners who will appreciate and love him the way he has been loved. Spent $7,000 on service training. He is a full-bred golden doodle, has experience on airplanes, has experience with people with autism. But Lori was told that she was not allowed to sell the dog. I believe, if my memory is correct, because I don't have it in front of me, she was trying to sell the dog for about $2,500. She was later told by the organization that she got the dog from that, nope, you cannot sell the dog. So the dog did go back to the breeder in the end. And I've been told that the dog has been placed, Bailey has been placed with another family with a boy with autism as well. On August 10th, 2019, that's the last time Kay Woodcock hears from JJ. It's via a FaceTime call that JJ would have made on his iPad, and the call was about 35 seconds long.
Call it a night. The party's over.
Larry and Kay Woodcock say they last spoke with their grandson, 7-year-old Joshua JJ Vallow, in August.
August 10th. A 35-second FaceTime.
The couple cared for JJ before he was adopted by Kay's brother, Charles, and his wife, Lori Vallow, in 2013.
Very honestly, things went extremely well for the first 5 years.
But Larry says things changed about 2 or 3 years ago, and Lori abandoned her family in February of last year.
Lori's just simply vanished.
58 days, she was completely gone.
Lori and Charles were members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, to which Charles converted after meeting Lori, according to Larry.
Charles loved the church.
But Lori had become radical, adopting religious beliefs outside the church, such as thinking herself the reincarnated version of Joseph Smith's wife.
She only was married to the top of the top in her reincarnation.
They also suspect Lori was having an affair with Chad Daybell, whom she met about 2 or 3 years ago.
I don't think there was any doubt that there was something going on. And obviously he was still married. And Lori was still married.
It's why they say Lori moved with JJ and her 17-year-old daughter, Tylee Ryan, to Rexburg shortly after Charles was killed in July by her brother.
Once they left Arizona, we lost total contact with her.
So on August 10th, 2019, Kay was like, okay, what's going on? She texts Lori to see JJ, and she never gets a response from Lori.
Kay Woodcock, his sister, sent this email to Lori. thanking her for letting them speak to JJ over FaceTime. She goes on to offer flying to Phoenix to spend time with JJ, maybe a trip to the zoo or an arcade. Kay never heard back. 15 days later, she sent another short email saying, "I'll do anything in order to see him."
I was trying to keep reaching out to her, reaching out to her, reaching out to her. Please let me talk to JJ. Let us see JJ. Whatever it takes, let us see him.
On September 18th, desperation was growing. By now, Lori, along with JJ and Tylee, moved to Rexburg, Idaho. Kay asked to see him for a weekend. She ends her email with, "Lori, what are you thinking? Are you even thinking?" And on October 14th, a final email is sent saying, "No need to cut him out of our lives. This situation can be managed civilly." Signed with, "Please tell him we love him."
She should have been worried more about being threatened by the police, because in every email I sent, I think I got ugly one or two times in those emails. After a little while, I'm like, come on, this is enough. Stop. And we need to see JJ.
Lori's family also claims that they heard JJ on a phone call on October 1st and Tylee in late September, slightly off from the timeline that police have.
Law enforcement is who I believe. The FBI is who I believe. Rexburg Police Department is who I believe.
As far as what Summer and Janice said, totally, totally irrelevant. It brings absolutely nothing to this case.
Kay and Larry say they haven't heard from Lori's side of the family throughout the investigation and wonder, why now?
You want to do something? Call us. Let's sit down. Let's have a meeting. Let's figure out where those kids are.
Let's be adults.
Please.
The one question that Kay and Larry want answered is simple. Where are JJ and Tylee? They hope that Lori's family puts pressure on her so they can put an end to all of this. Kim Powell for Arizona's Family.
So you can see as time is unfolding, Kay and Larry got really, really, really frustrated. We'll get into all those nitty-gritty details for sure. I'm going to continue through August, even though it gives you a little bit of a preview of what's happening in the months ahead. But just know these kids do go missing, and as early as August, the Woodcocks are getting really upset and concerned. On August 11th, Lori seems to be getting a little pissy with Chad. Now, remember, they have all these plans to be together. Fabulous plans to bring in had the 144,000. Amazing plans. Charles is dead. Lori's like, okay, come on, let's get this show on the road, right? In my mind, I picture Lori super impatient about everything. And so on August 11th, 2019, Lori sends Chad a text. They were probably having a difficult time, according to the FOIA documents, because Chad's still married, Tammy's still alive, and Lori's a widow now. So Lori's raring to go. So on August 11th, 2019, at 21:15, so 9:15 p.m., Lori sends Chad the following message. "You should give all of your love and your attention to your wife and family. I'm just a distraction. Go have fun with your family. I really do want you to. I just can't be in the way anymore. If things change, we can talk. But we have nothing until things change anyway." So Lori's getting pissy. Lori's like, get the hell rid of your wife, man. Like, that's what she's saying in no uncertain terms here. But after being upset with her little irritated text message, they must have kissed and made up via phone call or other texts that we are not privy to, because Lori begins buying wedding rings. Malachite wedding rings, one for her and one for Chad. Now remember this. Now this suggests that she was planning on marrying Chad. This is a screenshot of the rings she wants, these malachite rings. And then when they do get married, those rings are on their fingers. They have pictures of them on their wedding photos. So there is a message, which is to Melanie Boudreau, but it has quotes of the name Miriam. You know, these people, they all did different weird names and their burner phones and all that kind of stuff. So they try to make everything really confusing, which also proves to me that they knew what they were doing was kind of shady. So it says the number only appears as a contact in the Lori Force Style account. In the Lolly Time account, there's a message from this number to Lori, the blank number linked to Alex Cox. This message read, "It's Leilani Lay. Save my number for you guys only. Further content linked in this number to Melanie blank." Based on the content of the messages, Melanie was very close to Lori. Lori even sent Melanie photographs of malachite wedding rings on August 14th, 2019. This was prior to the death of Tammy Daybell and are the rings worn by Lori and Chad when they were married. If you think about that, that also suggests that Melanie Boudreau, niece Melanie, knew that Lori and Chad were planning on getting married at some point. And how can they get married? I mean, unless they're going to start this polygamy thing, which I don't think Tammy would be interested in, Tammy would have to die. The next day, August 15th, Lori purchases the wedding rings for herself. And that one would be a size 4. She also purchases a ring in size 11 and a half. Wonder what size Chad wears. She bought them for $129.99. Wednesday, August 14th, 2019, 11:30 p.m. Etsy order confirmation. It does show here the shipping address is Lori's address on Four Peaks Road in Chandler, Arizona. There's an actual picture of him. It says glow in the dark malachite inlay titanium ring, 8mm, ring size 4 US, material non-glowing inlay. Shop Serenity Rings. And then the other one, quantity 1, price $129.99, glow in the dark malachite inlay titanium ring, ring size 11.5 US, material non-glowing inlay. Shop Serenity Rings. Transaction ID, blah, 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 quantity 1, processing time 1 to 2 weeks, $129.99. Total order cost, $259.98. So I found that really interesting, and I'll go more into that malachite thing because, like I had mentioned before, one of my subscribers pointed out that Lori is very symbolic and things that Lori does have meaning. And with all this portal and you're meant to be this and all these, this stuff that Lori's believing, all this craziness, those malachite rings weren't very expensive. What does malachite mean to Lori and Chad? It has to be symbolic for something. And one of our suspicions is the way that they were murdering people was poisoning them with malachite. Now, that's just a suspicion, but I think it's a pretty good one. And we will get into that, I promise you. So that was all of that, which is pretty interesting that Lori, by August 15th, was buying wedding rings. Now, they did wind up canceling that order, but they must have gotten through something else that has not been released because the artist did cancel this order and refunded her money because he didn't have time to make the ring in time for whatever her deadline was. So according to the detectives, they said, "I did locate the maker of the wedding bands. Unfortunately, he informed me that he canceled the order because he was too busy with school. He operated his business on Etsy and has since closed his site. My guess is Lori utilized Etsy to purchase similar wedding bands. I think a warrant to Etsy should show this purchase." On August 16th, Lori moves Tylee Ryan's Social Security benefit deposit from Tylee's Chase account to her own. And then on August 17th, Lori reserves a moving van with Budget in preparation for her move. Budget van rental created on August 17th, 2019. So on August 18th, 2019, Melanie Gibb, who was being referred to as Phoebe at this point, and referred to as Lori's daughter in a previous life. They all met at Lori's house. It was one of those women meeting things that they had with the other ladies. The casting out meetings, I'm assuming. Phoebe is part of the group of females that gathered at Lori's residence in Chandler, Arizona on 8/18/2019. Looking at photographs sent from Phoebe to Lori, it is believed that Phoebe is Melanie Gibb. And then a few days later, on August 22nd, 2019, Lori Vallow and Melanie Gibb begin a new podcast called Feel the Fire. They kick it off with an episode titled Feel the Fire, Seeking and Finding Sweet Jesus. So I was able to find one of the episodes of Lori and Melanie Gibb's Feel the Fire podcast. And it's probably a good one to share because their special guest is none other than Chad Daybell. I'm only going to play a few minutes for you. It's about 30 minutes long, but I can put the link in the show notes. It's a little difficult to listen to. I consider Chad as extremely boring, very monotone, and a liar. This podcast goes into how he came face to face with Jesus in a couple of times. And Lori's like, what color were his eyes? What color was his hair? How was his personality? You know, in the meantime, when they're recording this, they've already murdered Charles and a few other murders are in the works. So I have a hard time. It actually really makes me want to vomit and it makes me really angry that these murderers, these serial killers, are talking about Jesus as if they truly believe and are Christians. It actually makes me sick. But I'm going to play it for you so you can hear a few minutes of it. It's Melanie Gibb, Lori Vallow, and Chad Daybell.
You are here with Lori and Melanie this morning on our podcast, Feel the Fire. And this morning, we had an opportunity to interview someone named Chad Daybell, who has had many experiences with the Savior of this world. Because of our love for Jesus Christ, we wanted other people to know how much He is an invitation to come unto Him, how much He wants us to become part of His life, because He's already there. He's just waiting for us. And so we want to talk to Chad about his personal experiences with the Savior, where he's had many experiences because of his near-death experiences, and I'm sure more personal ones as well, that he has seen our Savior, and he wants us to know that Jesus wants us to come unto Him and to come to know Him.
So we're here with Chad Daybell, and he is on our Feel the Fire podcast today. And we really want to talk to Chad about his experiences with Jesus. And we know that you've had some pretty amazing experiences, and that's what we're here to do, is to testify of Jesus and who He is and who He is to us. So, Chad, hi.
Hello. Glad to be on the podcast with you.
Thank you.
We're excited to have you and happy that you could come on with us today. Why don't you start with, like, your first experience is with Jesus and kind of who He is to you.
Okay. I grew up in a Christian home, but honestly, other than Sunday, we didn't really talk about Jesus at all. My parents grew up in the 60s, and they were doing a good job as parents, but religion always kind of took a backseat to everything else. But when I was 18 years old, I decided to serve a mission for my church. And as part of that, we went to a training center. And my first real experience with Jesus was about 2 weeks into that training, where one of the other missionaries read a poem about how Jesus came to earth to sacrifice for us so that we could someday return and live with Him. And made me feel closer to Jesus than I ever had. It made Him feel like a real person to me. He wasn't just a painting on the wall or somebody that we said at the name, His name at the end of a prayer. And so I just started bawling, and the rest of the missionaries thought I'd lost my mind or something, but I could not stop crying, and the burning in my chest was so strong that I finally could still a connection to Jesus that I'd never felt before. And he felt like a friend to me. And so as I went out into the mission field, I carried that with me, even during the hard times. And there were times where it felt like...
August 20th to August 25th, 2019, Lori travels from Phoenix to Idaho and back under the name of Lori Ryan. While she's there, she takes pictures of Kennedy Elementary School, which will be the future elementary school that JJ will attend. And she also takes pictures of BYU. So she flew on Allegiant Airlines, and there's a confirmation number. And she traveled from Idaho to Phoenix under the name of Lori Ryan. Again, back home, Allegiant Airlines confirmation number is there. So it sounds to me, and probably to you too, that she was getting ready to make the big move. Remember, her landlord told her she needed to be out by the end of August. And she's a widow, and she's expecting to be together with Chad. So where's Lori going? She's going to be with Chad. But Tammy Daybell is a thorn in her side, so she's threatening Chad that maybe she'll just talk to him some other time once, you know, he needs focus on his family. Little games, little guilt, little... you better get rid of your wife or you're going to lose me kind of stuff, right? On August 24th, 2019, there's some money transferred to Colby from Lori. And on August 25th, 2019, Kay Vallow Woodcock sends Lori that other message begging her to FaceTime and visit JJ. So on August 27th, Lori starts setting up all her utilities and stuff. She set up her internet and utilities in her soon-to-be apartment townhouse up in Rexburg at 565 Pioneer Road. And on August 28th, Alex's apartment was taken off the market because Alex follows Lori to Rexburg. Now on August 30th, Lori stops by the workplace of Colby, her son, to tell him in the parking lot that she, Tylee, and JJ were moving the next day. Colby said he didn't ask where they were moving, and he didn't find out that they had moved to Rexburg until detectives came to his door a few months later. Colby says that the last time he ever spoke to Tylee over FaceTime was on August 30th, 2019. He tells detectives after that, Lori kept giving him excuses why he couldn't speak to his sister. So let's listen to Colby explain the last time he saw his mother and his sister and JJ.
So let's go to August 30th. You're at work. Mm-hmm. And tell me what happens when your mom... is it August 30th? This is the day before they move?
So the day before they move, they came. Yeah, so they came... drove up, told me that they were there. So I was like, okay, I'll come out in a minute. So I came out and it was my mom, Tylee, and JJ. And I just, you know, they came and said, we're leaving tomorrow. We wanted to just come say bye. Tylee was in the car. She was emotional. You know, she looked upset. JJ jumped out, you know, hugged him, kissed him, you know, hugged my mom, told him I love him. Like, I'm always here as a support, you know, hopefully like everything works out. And I told him, like, just try to restart whatever you're doing. Try to just like reset and try to go forward now. Like find a place, make it a base, make it a place that you settle into and let everybody just calm down.
Were you actually kind of relieved that she was moving to start fresh?
Yeah. I mean, for them, I was. For the kids, I was like, they need to be out of the house that happened in. And they need, I didn't know if she was going to leave Arizona, but I knew that they needed to get out of that situation and just try to be in a new environment.
Yeah, elaborate on that. She said, why was she moving and where?
Yeah, she said, I got a new job and that she was moving. So that was it. That's all she told me. And she didn't tell me where. And I just kept it to a place where I was like, as long as the kids are okay, as long as you're okay, and you're taking them to start new, then that's all I want for them is to be okay and to have a new place to live and be okay.
What is Tylee saying to you about the move?
She didn't really say anything. She just looked so emotional. She looked like she was sad. She looked like she didn't want to go. I know all her friends are here. And so she just seemed like she wasn't ready to move again. Like, she's been through so much moving.
So her expression, she wasn't really expressing her, you could see it.
Yeah,
she wasn't telling you.
Exactly.
And she wasn't giving you much information. She's just not happy right now. The way you looked at her and said bye.
Yeah.
And she said bye to you. She said, I love you.
Yeah, exactly. And like, she's very protective of JJ. And so she would do anything to go with him and protect him. So I knew that about her. I know that's why she would go, because she does have friends and family here. So it was like, she went for JJ.
And she's also 17. This is her family.
Yeah,
she's
exactly.
Going. At what point do you find out that they're going to Idaho?
I didn't know they were going to Idaho. I found out that they were in Idaho recently. That's
Take
where they
me
were.
There. Detectives come and ask you where the kids are.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you find out what happened.
They came to the door and they asked me where my little sister is and where JJ is. And I'm like, what are you, like, how are you asking me? I don't know. Like, I don't have them. And they came looking for him here, thinking that they would be here. And so I just opened the door thinking, like, why are two detectives at the door? And when we had that conversation, just like, you know what I mean? Like, what do you mean? Where's like Tylee? Like, I was freaking out because I didn't know what they were going to say. And so we had that conversation. I came inside and I'm like looking around, like my wife's looking at me and we're just thinking, what is going on? So I called my mom and I'm like, you know, two detectives just came to my door. What is going on? And she said, I got it. I'll take care of it. Love you. And that was it.
That was it.
Yeah.
I got it. I'll take care of it. I love you.
Yeah. I mean, it was a little bit of a conversation, but that was really it. That's what it was. Like, you know, she asked me what they asked. I said, they asked for Tylee. I said, where's Tylee? Why are they asking me?
This was November 26th.
So I find that interesting. The only part of that entire thing that I find really kind of questionable is, why wouldn't Colby ask his mom where they were going? Tylee's upset. They're there to say goodbye. And he's just like, okay. I just picture myself, if I drove up to my son, my 23-year-old son right now, Colby and my son are close to the same age, my youngest. And I said, hey, hi, I'm leaving. We're out of here. Love you. Gave you a hug and a kiss. Packed up to move. He would ask me where I was going. Oh, what's your new address? Where are you going? Are you staying in Chandler? Are you moving to Timbuktu? Are you flying off to Hawaii? Like, these people moved a lot. So why wouldn't he think to ask? You know, they moved to Houston, they moved to Phoenix, they moved to Hawaii, they bebopped everywhere. So I really struggle with why Colby did not ask them where they were going. That one just really bothers me about him and that whole thing, that conversation. And maybe it'll come out someday. I don't know. But that's the one part of that I have a hard time understanding. When I'm back from my vacation and I start recording again, I should have my next episode and the start of season 2 up the first or second week of October 2022. We will dive right in until September, where it really starts getting intense, because this is when the kids go missing and it becomes even more horrific, more sad, more heinous than you could ever imagine. Thank you again. I'm Kathy. Stay safe. Stay well. Bye-bye. This has been a production of Afterglow Unveiling the Idaho Cult, Season 1. I'm your host, Kathy Brooks. I'm also the editor, the producer, and the narrator. Thank you so much again. And sources for this particular episode were Justin Lump, Fox 10 Phoenix, Nate Eaton, East Idaho News, and KTVB News, as well as analytics.com, Annie Cushing, and Arizona Family.